Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Where are we headed if we don't make any progress in Alzheimer's research? A recent report in the journal Neurology says that by 2050, nearly 14 million Americans could have Alzheimer's, the most common form of dementia already. That's nearly triple the incidence of Alzheimer's from just 2 years ago. These dire predictions are not for lack of effort. There is the recent operation at OSU in which a pacemaker was inserted into the patient's brain to treat the disease, and efforts continue to dissect Alzheimer's genetically. And the FDA has approved the testing of a new drug that could slow or even prevent Alzheimer's. What's more, the Obama administration last year announced the creation of the National Plan to Address Alzheimer's Disease. And they set a goal of finding effective treatment and prevention approaches by 2025. In the meantime, most experts recommend a lifestyle rich in exercise and a Mediterranean-style diet and no smoking. Joining us now to talk about Alzheimer's lifestyle and food is geriatric neurologist and dementia specialist, Dr. Marwan Subba. Dr. Subba is the research medical director of the Banner Sun Health Research Institute in Arizona, and he's co-author of a new cookbook aimed at preventing Alzheimer's. Welcome to the show, Dr. Subba.
Thank you for having me.
To our listeners, if you have a question or comment for Dr. Subba about Alzheimer's, we welcome your participation, 614-292-8513. So what do we know about Alzheimer's now that suggests that treatments are more viable than a cure at this point?
Yes, yeah, so this has been a really difficult phase of the Alzheimer's space, particularly in the area of therapeutics. 2012 was a watershed year insofar as we saw a lot of drugs that we had had hope for, major drugs, major companies, major programs, not meet expectations insofar as breaking through with effective treatments. And when we talk about effective, we're really talking about arresting the progression, slowing it down. And so that was really disappointing, and I think people are scratching their heads and wondering how we could have been so far off when expectations were so high. Cure is to take it out of the brain as if it was never there. I think we're a long way off, unfortunately, from being able to cure Alzheimer's, and I'll explain why later in the program. But there are still 75 drugs in clinical trials and 200 in development, so we're a long way off from giving up.
Is there a sense that Alzheimer's is something of a moving target, that it's changing?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true, and I think that's really reflective of the fact that we every year we understand the biology more, and these failures that we saw with the major drug companies, major drug programs from last year make us think about the fact that Alzheimer's is a much more difficult disease to treat, target, understand than we had originally thought. And, you know, we've been focusing on trying to remove amyloid, which is a protein that accumulates in Alzheimer's, thinking that that was a good idea, and that just hasn't worked so far. So we're now going back and rethinking what might be a better idea.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and my guest is Dr. Marwan Subba. He's a neurologist and also the co-author of the Alzheimer's Prevention Cookbook. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Subba, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. I mentioned earlier the projected increase in the number of Alzheimer's diagnoses in the next 40-odd years. Is that just a function of a larger population or an older population, or is it an actual percentage rise, you know, all things being equal?
All things being equal, it probably is a reflection mostly of the aging population and mostly of the bad habits that we have adopted. You keep in mind, of course, that in the year 1900, the life expectancy was 47. In the year 2000, the life expectancy was 77. And the life expectancy in the year 2100 is expected to be near to 90. So we're living longer. That's just a plain fact. By the middle of this century, there'll be 2 billion people over the age of 60 in the world. That's one of the things. But the second thing, of course, is that we're not being good to ourselves, and we're just slowly and methodically increasing our risk, not just through family history and genetics, but lifestyle habits are also impacting our risk down the road.
We're living longer, and so that increases the percentage. But some people get the early onset Alzheimer's or early onset dementia. There might be a distinction, of course, between them. But do we learn anything from those people?
Well, let me answer that in two ways. First of all, when we talk about dementia, dementia is a category of disease. It's like saying cancer. If you said, I have cancer, somebody's going to ask you, well, what kind of cancer? Dementia is a category of disease where you have memory loss or cognitive impairment bad enough to affect your daily life. That is the technical definition of dementia. So Alzheimer's disease is a form of dementia. So all Alzheimer's is dementia, but not all dementia is Alzheimer's disease. But we do understand that there's things that can influence risk as we learn more about the disease. And early onset Alzheimer's disease seems to have a very rich genetic component, meaning there's a familial aspect that really influences the probability of developing it. Very, very few people actually get early onset Alzheimer's disease. And usually you can identify why.
As far as the increase in, when we talk about increases in Alzheimer's, are we also looking at overall increases in the category of dementia?
That's a good question, and I don't know that I know the answer to that. The general impression is yes, but most of the focus has been around Alzheimer's disease, and the answer is absolutely yes to Alzheimer's disease. But I'm not sure if it's getting more common in other dementias. I'll have to get back to you on that, actually.
Okay. And, we mentioned that people are living longer, since it's an age-related disease, we're going to have more people that way. But you also mentioned we're not being very good to ourselves. Our diet is intuitive if you're thinking about avoiding things like dementia and Alzheimer's.
Correct. I know we'll kind of do a deeper dive later in the program, but what we're starting to realize is that, and this comes a little bit out of my first book, is that we break risk into two general categories, what we call modifiable risk and non-modifiable risk. A non-modifiable risk is your age, your gender, your family history, your genetics. A modifiable risk is your weight, your diet, your high blood pressure, your diabetes, your cholesterol. One of the things that has become very apparent is that certain health conditions like type 2 diabetes, like obesity, like high blood pressure and high cholesterol, all confer increased risk for developing Alzheimer's disease in your lifetime.
How do you study diet in relation to a disease like Alzheimer's?
Yeah, that's a tricky business, as you would guess. There are standardized, validated questionnaires called FFQs, Food Frequency Questionnaires. It's basically like taking a questionnaire of everybody in Columbus and seeing what they eat, how often they eat it, and deciding on the basis of that you could identify trends and patterns. And that's where much of the food-based research comes from in Alzheimer's, is these FFQs. Obviously, they're a very blunt instrument because there's a lot of variability in what people eat on a day-to-day basis. But we kind of take things in trends, not just an individual report. You know, if you say you have an individual report, you say, well, that's interesting, but where's the trend? There's a larger body of science to support it that makes more sense.
So the incidence of Alzheimer's in the U.S. is expected to triple by 2050. Is that trajectory based just on our age and our diets, or what are we making that judgment from?
Right. The age is clearly one of the biggest reasons, is that we are getting older. The largest segment of the population that's growing is the 80-plus and even the centenarian group. But the other thing is, of course, we have, unfortunately, the American public is more obese than many other places in the world. We have more hypertension, diabetes, and high cholesterol than many other places in the world. So it's a convergence of many, many things, aging plus health conditions plus dietary choices that are influencing our risk.
From the research, in the research field, when something is so much more prevalent in one country than another country, is there still worldwide interest in treating it and curing it, in learning more about it?
Yes, and so Alzheimer's disease affects 27 million people worldwide. It is not only front-loaded on the U.S. population. We know that the incidence goes up and down, up or down, depending on where you are in the world. We know, for example, in India, they have the lowest incidence of Alzheimer's disease in the world. But it does vary. But it's no It's not like any country or any ethnic group is completely spared, except for one group in Iceland. They're completely spared of Alzheimer's, apparently.
And as far as India goes, it's not, in general, a very high mortality rate, right?
No. So India, when you control for age, because, you know, you would expect the life expectancy to be a little bit lower in India. When you control for age, the incidence of Alzheimer's disease in India is about one quarter of what it is in the developed world, particularly in the U.S. And there's three factors that are generally considered as the likely contributors to the protective benefits. One is their body mass index is lower. Mm-hmm. Two is they have less saturated fat in their diet. And three is they eat turmeric or curcumin. And a lot of people think that that's one of the most protective antioxidant spices that you can consume. And an average Indian person eats about one teaspoon per day. And that's maybe one of the reasons why they get less Alzheimer's.
You know, when it comes to things like cinnamon, turmeric, and we can talk about all of that later are things like that, spices like that have been with us for almost as long as recorded history, are those kinds of things something that researchers like you automatically look to, or do you try to find something different to treat with?
Well, researchers like me and my colleagues, for example, at Oregon State, Ohio State, really are trying to go for pharmaceutical-based research approaches, mm-hmm. Drug discovery. We really don't look at naturopathic or nutraceutical-type approaches, although there's a gigantic amount of research in much of it not very rigorous, but still there's a large amount of research in non-pharmacological approaches. During the research for my book, I was very surprised to see that there were about five or six spices that had huge antioxidant potential, and a couple of which have been studied specifically in Alzheimer's models, turmeric and cinnamon being some of the two that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Dr. Marwan Sabha. He is a geriatric neurologist and the co-author of the Alzheimer's Prevention Cookbook. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back. I'm talking with Dr. Marwan Sabha. He is, geriatric neurologist and dementia specialist. He's the research medical director of the Banner Sun Health Research Institute in Arizona and co-author of a new cookbook aimed at preventing Alzheimer's. It's called the Alzheimer's Prevention Cookbook. Once again, Dr. Sabha, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you again.
I mentioned at the beginning of the program that most experts recommend a lifestyle rich in exercise and a Mediterranean-style diet and no smoking. Do you guys just throw in the no smoking thing just in case? Or is there anything that really ties smoking or nicotine or smoke in the lungs with Alzheimer's?
Yeah, so nicotine is a tricky business and smoking is too. There are early epidemiological studies suggested that smokers had a reduced risk for developing Alzheimer's disease. Certainly, we know that seems to be the case. If you ever believe there's only one good thing about smoking, it actually reduces your risk for Parkinson's, but that should not be a reason to go out and start smoking, mm-hmm. Because, of course, before you reduce your risk of Parkinson's, you'll get other diseases. But there was early evidence that it did reduce the risk for Alzheimer's. And the reason is very simply that smoking, nicotine is a surrogate of a brain chemical called acetylcholine, which is the brain chemical lost in Alzheimer's disease. So a lot of people thought I could give more nicotine to my brain and therefore act like the acetylcholine. Later epidemiological studies suggested that protection was not evident and that smokers had a slight increased risk for Alzheimer's disease. Not a hugely increased, but slight. And it may be that the nicotine is offset by all the other things you consume when you smoke, including a heavy load of free radicals when you smoke. So the current wisdom is that smoking has a slight increased risk for developing Alzheimer's disease. But the nicotine story is a separate one and a very interesting one. We think that nicotine, actually, we've been developing drugs around nicotine as treatments for Alzheimer's disease. So it's a mixed bag.
Is it highly likely or likely at all that even within the Alzheimer's-specific category that there are going to be lots of different treatments and it kind of depends on the person?
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the things we have been very short-sighted in the therapeutics arena is that we have to consider that Alzheimer's disease is a much more complex disease than we had thought, and that we're going to really have to take the chemotherapy-type approach to treating Alzheimer's disease. It's not going to be one drug to one target, but multiple drugs to multiple targets that's going to make a big difference. And I think the real issue that we have not talked about is we're starting to realize that maybe we're treating too late. Treating symptomatic Alzheimer's disease is like treating metastatic cancer. It's a little bit late to get into it. It's kind of like trying to put out the fire once the house is burned down. And one of the alarming things we discovered recently is that the dementia of Alzheimer's disease, as you and I know it, is the end of the disease, not the beginning of it, and that symptoms start 25 years after the first day they start to make changes in their brain. So 25 years later is when we get memory loss. And so we really have to start looking harder at prevention.
To what extent have the brain scans and the brain scan technology helped identify Alzheimer's?
Absolutely. That's one of the major breakthroughs in the last 5 to 10 years is that the technology, PET technology, which has been used for a long time for cancer staging, we now develop new radio contrast agents, imaging contrast dyes. And what they do is you inject them and they identify amyloid in the brain. So we can now look for markers of specific to the disease in the brain. And that's a very exciting thing. And now one of those radio contrast agents is already approved as a diagnostic, as a potential diagnostic for Alzheimer's disease. So it's a big breakthrough.
How do you know? Is it required that when somebody dies from dementia or with dementia that they be autopsied and you figure out what it was?
Well, we'd love that, but most people don't. I mean, you know, big institutions like Ohio State and ours at Banner have a large autopsy program to track people to autopsy. So, because we really want to learn more and more about the disease.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is most people don't. And they kind of quietly bury their loved one and and be done with it. But I think that's really short-sighted because, of course, we want to know what an individual risks is, and one of the things we can do is look at tissue to do that. And National Institutes of Health fund 30 centers of excellence around the country related to Alzheimer's research, and one of their focuses is brain donation.
You know, I mentioned the Obama administration last year announced the creation of the National Plan to Address Alzheimer's Disease and set that 2025 goal for treatment and prevention. What does that really mean in real terms to someone like you out there in the trenches?
I'll choose my words carefully.
Okay.
The NAPA Act was a good first step in the right direction, but it was basically shifting things around. The truth is that the NIA has a $600 million budget for Alzheimer's research. And the NAPA Act only added about $80 million, basically taken from not new money, but taken from other buckets to put into the Alzheimer's research bucket. We are dreadfully as a society underfunding Alzheimer's research. When you will consider it's the sixth or seventh leading cause of death, depending on what statistic you quote. You know, France spends, as I found out from when President Sarkozy and lectured the Congress that we were all at last year, is that they spend 20 times more per person on Alzheimer's research than we do in the U.S. It's really sad. We should be spending tenfold, not $600 million, $6 billion on Alzheimer's research, and yet we don't get that kind of funding.
You know, if somebody's interested in the bottom line, the obvious question is, how much is Alzheimer's costing us?
It's interesting you asked me that question. Newt Gingrich, before he ran for president, convened a panel, advisory panel, called the Alzheimer's Study Group, and I had the honor of serving on the Alzheimer's Study Group. And he said, you know, it's a $170 billion disease now. It'll be a $1 trillion disease by the middle of this century. So it is not a small or cheap disease. And most people will tell you who have loved ones with Alzheimer's disease, it sucks up your life savings, it sucks up your time. It's a wrecking ball in people's lives.
Probably a lot of people aren't diagnosed, or they're not treated, or no one's really paying attention because they don't have health insurance. Are you encouraged at all that maybe more people will start seeing a doctor earlier, and these kinds of the symptoms that might trigger some treatments or will be caught sooner? More
Absolutely.
Often, I should say.
Absolutely. And I would say that has been a major positive trend, is that we're going to be screening people more routinely earlier and earlier. And I think that will have a better long-term benefit. But, you know, most people have to know that the cost of care on the Alzheimer's side on the front end is paid for by, insurance and Medicare but the back end, the long-term care, if you're smart to buy long-term care, good for you. If you're not, then you're going to pay cash, because Medicare doesn't cover some of the larger costs of Alzheimer's care related to institutional-based care. So it's a very expensive disease as you get more into the disease.
If one has had a relative, a close relative, a grandparent or a parent die of some kind of dementia, and I wanted to get back to that idea, they're not sure what kind. Do you recommend that they at least have some kind of genetic workup?
Well, the answer is no.
Okay.
The American Academy of Neurology and the American Medical Association do not recommend genetic screening of people without symptoms, because Congress passed a law called the GINA Act, the Genetic Information Non-Discriminability Act, which said you cannot lose your ability to get health care insurance on the basis of your genetic profile, but you can. They were specific to exempt long-term care insurance. So if you came back positive for genetic risk for Alzheimer's disease, you might be considered uninsurable from a long-term care perspective.
Okay. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking to Dr. Marwan Subba. He's a geriatric neurologist and a dementia expert. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Why can't we just take supplements if diet is a part of the equation? Why can't I just take vitamin B, for instance, and maybe whatever that helps will help that way?
No, I think that's a good first step. I think what people have to be is realistic on what supplements can and cannot do. Supplements like B vitamins are good sources of nutrients, which are important for brain health. But the diet... You cannot, eat a bad diet full of saturated fat and other unhealthy things and think that, if I just take a handful of supplements, it's going to offset my dietary habits. You have to basically embrace prevention in totality. And so I would say taking supplements is a good idea as part of a general healthier lifestyle.
Omar and Powell, you're on the air with Dr. Marwan Subba. Welcome, Omar.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Dr. Sabah. How are you?
Hi, fine. Thank you.
Good. I have a question, actually. I came from the Middle East, and we use, as you may know, we use the same spices as India, curcumin, fenugreek, cinnamon. And I'm just wondering if the Middle East has as low rate of Alzheimer's as India.
Well, unfortunately, being of Middle Eastern background, I know that the answer is that we do not have a lower incidence of Alzheimer's disease because, as you know, Arabs eat a lot of meat and red meat and saturated fat in their diet. So we hope that these spices would be a good idea, but unfortunately we eat a very heavy saturated fat diet. And so the risk of Alzheimer's disease is not lower in the Middle East. I wish it was.
So besides spices, then would you recommend vegetarian or vegan diet?
Well, vegetarian or diets lower in saturated fat. So things more fish. Less meat would be, and more olive oil, as we eat in the Middle East, we would have more olive oil as well. But it cannot be simply the spices that are sufficient. You need to basically make a lot of changes together.
Okay. I was just curious. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Omar.
Thank you.
If you want to give us a call, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from Trudy. She asks, could you discuss IVIG for the treatment of Alzheimer's? Even though the research seemed to show good results, it is almost never mentioned these days. And I guess it stands for intravenous immune globulin?
Yeah, so that's a very interesting question. IVIG is also known as gamma globulin, and it's been used for about 30 years to treat all kinds of neurological and other conditions. So we have basically what they do is they take blood products and skim out the antibodies and concentrate them, and then they administer them to people who need them. A few years ago, when we started looking at immunotherapies for Alzheimer's disease, a very smart scientist and physician in New York, Dr. Relkin, posed the idea of using IVIG as a treatment for Alzheimer's disease. And now we're in the third phase of a large clinical program, both done by the federal government and by Baxter, and we're looking at the possibility of seeing some results by April, May, June of this year, discussing if IVIG is an effective treatment for Alzheimer's disease. That's the good news. The second good news about that is we have a lot of experience, so we feel pretty comfortable with the safety profile for IVIG. The bad news is there's a limited supply of IVIG because it's a blood-derived product. And the second bad news is that it's going to be frightfully expensive. Mm. And the third bad news is that, according to the clinical trials, it's every two-week dose of intravenous treatment. So we haven't seen the last on it, but it is an exciting development.
I mentioned also the development at OSU as far as the pacemakers in the brain go. And, of course, that's extremely expensive right now. It's at that stage. But eventually, it's predicted that if this works and so forth, it could become almost as routine. It's not cheap, but routine to as having a pacemaker for your heart.
I think that's an ambitious idea. The backstory about that is that deep brain stimulation has been used for 15 years to treat tremor and Parkinson's disease.
Mm-hmm.
And a surgeon, basically, the way we found out this was a good idea is he stuck the wire in the wrong place. And instead of it treating their tremor or their Parkinson's disease, their memory got better. So it was kind of serendipitous. And I believe that pacemakers would be a good idea to maybe improve memory. But the question is if the disease changes are occurring at the molecular level, how is a pacemaker going to stop a brain-wide disease? And that's the thing we haven't figured out yet.
Mary in Linden, you're on the air. Welcome, Mary.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Welcome.
My question is that I'm 60 years old and work as an executive administrative assistant, so very, stressful, demanding kind of work. And, I started, a lot of people do, after 50, starting noticing that you can't recall phone numbers, you can't recall people's names. Or
can't recall what I had for breakfast.
Yeah. it's kind of progressed to something like, my purse, my bag, my coffee, and I'll, get on the road. Oh, the coffee's still sitting, at home. I'm looking right at it when I, leave the house. And I queried I have a new GP, and she's a young doctor, so I was hoping, she's up on everything. And I said, should I be concerned about, my memory loss? Should I be tested? She said, well, as long as you're able to do all your tasks and you're not forgetting the steps in a task, that you don't have to worry. So is that correct?
Well, that's a good question. Just how do you know? It's short of you're saying you don't recommend any kind of genetic testing if someone doesn't have any symptoms. But what about if you're in that age group and you're starting to worry that things are not as sharp as they used to be?
Right. So that's a very common complaint, particularly in postmenopausal women. They go through the change of life and then they feel a little bit less sharp and a little more forgetful. That's a very, very common complaint. Good news for you is that most of the time that doesn't turn out to be the beginning of Alzheimer's disease. Almost never it is. And we think part of it is that the changes in the in life with menopause also affect brain signaling, particularly related to estrogen. So far, what I would say to you is I'm not very worried if it becomes noticeable, if it impacts your work, if it impact, if people are starting to notice it, then I say, okay, maybe I should go get tested. Other things that people are trying to do now is the brain training exercises and maybe even supplements to offset that kind of change. But at this point, we don't think that those kinds of changes are the beginnings of Alzheimer's.
Thank you very much, Mary, for the call. We've talked about brain plasticity on the show before, and but that doesn't apply to something like Alzheimer's.
Well, the brain plasticity issue is once you have symptomatic Alzheimer's disease, we don't think that brain training exercises has as much benefit as you would think. We think that brain training exercises under the umbrella of plasticity are really better in the prevention in the pre-symptomatic phase than they are in the fully symptomatic phase, as we're starting to appreciate many things are. But there's a lot of the science about brain plasticity as it relates to protecting you against Alzheimer's is a bit murky, and so we can talk about that, but it's not as clear-cut as we would think.
Are there any examples out there of people who you know have Alzheimer's, but it's not progressing, or it progresses at a different rate, or are there just already just you know there are different rates of progression?
Everybody progresses at a slightly different rate. If you're a slow progressor, you tend to stay a slow progressor. If you're a fast progressor, you tend to stay a fast progressor. If you have certain genetic risks called the apolipoprotein E4, you tend to progress a little faster. If you have more certain neuropsychiatric features, hallucinations, delusions, etc., you tend to progress more quickly. If you're older, you tend to not progress as quickly, although your life expectancy is shorter. So there are a lot of factors that go into predicting progression.
And just really quickly, we have an email from Stephen. I just want to go over this very briefly again.
Sure.
He asks, if Alzheimer's is in the genes, why does it happen to older people only? But that's not the case.
Well, and if Alzheimer's is in genes, that's a good question. And that's a question we have not answered in science yet. So we do think that environment and genetics interact. And aging, of course, is ultimately our ability to fight off damage to our DNA. That's what people think is the general principle of what aging is. And sometimes that not fighting off the damage is kind of beginning the process that leads to losing our ability to fight off Alzheimer's changes. That's the theory. Truth is that we don't have a clean answer for the question.
My guest, once again, is Dr. Marwan Sabbah. He is the Research Medical Director at Banner Sun Health Research Institute in Arizona, co-author of a new cookbook aimed at preventing Alzheimer's. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is geriatric neurologist and dementia specialist, Dr. Marwan Sabbah. If you have a question for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Dr. Sabbah, you've said that you're confident that in the future we'll make Alzheimer's a chronic disease instead of a terminal illness.
Correct.
Does that mean I might get it, but treat it so that the symptoms are minimal? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes. That's one that I believe is the first of the three waves of the future for Alzheimer's disease. We're already starting to see that we're starting to make some headway in the treatment, and over time we're going to see that we're being able to slow the progression down. And that's what these drugs that are in development are really specifically intended to do. The second wave of the future will be to identify people at risk prior to their symptoms, and third is to a prevention strategy. And I will tell you that all three areas are being actively pursued at this time.
And also, are you satisfied that nursing homes and other residences for older adults are embracing the tenets of the diet that you recommend in your book?
I wish that was true. The answer is flatly no. The truth is that that book is really more aimed for the family or the children of the loved ones who are already in the long-term care facility, who are probably wondering, oh, my God, my mother or father has Alzheimer's disease. What can I do to prevent myself from getting it? And that's really what the book is really targeted toward. Long-term care has not kind of adopted any kind of wholesale changes in dietary to reduce risk because they're already having symptoms.
So let's turn to the cookbook briefly and talk about one thing that kind of intrigued me. Well, you've talked about diabetes and dementia, but I was wondering, it's on the rise. So is there a direct connection or is it just a correlation at this point?
The original estimate was a correlation, but the science is very, very robust, suggesting there is a direct interaction. And it's around several things. First, there is insulin resistance in the brain of people with Alzheimer's disease, meaning that the brain's not metabolizing sugar in a normal, healthy manner. Second is that type 2 diabetes doubles your risk for developing Alzheimer's disease, probably related to that insulin resistance. Third is we know that the enzyme called IDE, insulin degrading enzyme, which is the enzyme that breaks down insulin, also has an effect on amyloid. So there's a clear diabetes interaction with the Alzheimer's changes. And we've known these changes for a while, so there's been multiple drugs tried, diabetic drugs to treat Alzheimer's disease. The latest that's getting a lot of excitement is this year there'll be a clinical trial looking at insulin nasal spray as a treatment for Alzheimer's disease.
We have an email from Stephanie. She asks, what role does head trauma during middle age play in getting Alzheimer's?
A critically important role and a very unfortunate role. And that, of course, as you know, is getting a lot of attention. And as you see all these unfortunate injuries related to football players, you look at all their brains, every one of them have Alzheimer's disease, even in their 40s. So we believe that Alzheimer's changes, in fact, increases your risk for developing, chronic head injury, traumatic brain injury, and the like. Increase your risk, your lifetime risk for developing Alzheimer's disease. That's actually been proven over and over and over again. And that mechanistically they're related because head injury seems to accelerate the changes that lead to Alzheimer's down the road.
So when Stephanie makes the specific reference to a during middle age head trauma, that's not as relevant as a head trauma in general.
Correct. Well, no, we think that any head trauma.
Yeah.
Particularly those with loss of consciousness seem to increase your lifetime risk. The timing of it is not as clearly identified, but the severity is, and people with severe head traumas clearly increase the risk over time.
I would imagine that these football players who are letting themselves be studied now are a big help.
Absolutely, and it's a major change in the culture because for a long time, they were very resistant to being studied or addressed because they were afraid they would lose their livelihood. So that's a major change in step forward. But I think the legality of the issue and the ethics of the issue have not been completely agreed upon. So I think we have not had the final say on it. But it's a really important kind of conversation to have. The other part of that is that these veterans coming home from the newest Gulf War are experiencing a lot of these concussive, non-penetrating blasts. So nowadays, the bombs will give out these concussive shockwaves that knocks everybody out in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
And the average veteran's coming home with 20, 30, 40 concussive knockouts, as if you were, in a boxing ring and knocked out. You're getting 20 or 30 of those from your war experience. And that's really clearly going to have a major impact down the road.
Mm-hmm. Ken in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you and good morning. I'm very interested in this particular topic. I'm a 62-year-old, beyond work, and I try to eat well and stay active. My particular question deals with dairy products, and I know you've spoken to the ingestion of red meat as being too much red meat. Are there anything in the studies that point to dairy products per se, the consumption of milks and cheeses, and its relationship to some of the diseases we're speaking of?
This is where the science gets soft. softer when we identify specific foods. But dairy products can have a lot of saturated fat, and therefore it could be kind of lumped into those categories that we would prefer not to be consuming on a regular basis. But the science is not clear enough to say specifically dairy products are bad or not. The red meats do seem to have some problems with them.
Ken, thanks a lot for that call. We appreciate it. Greg in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hello, thank you. Mm-hmm. My question has to do with caffeine. We know that caffeine increases the transmission of dopamine, and Alzheimer's patients seem to have lower dopamine. So by ingesting a lot more caffeine, do we see a positive change? And have we done anything with something like an amphetamine to see if we can at least enhance function? I'll take my answer off here. Thank you.
Thanks, Greg.
So there's two answers to that question. So let me take the amphetamine question first. Amphetamines have been looked at too as the treatment stimulants, as treatments for some of the negative symptoms we see in Alzheimer's, particularly apathy and anergia, where they just kind of lumps on the log. And there's recent evidence that taking stimulants like amphetamines can have benefit. But this is, again, in a clinical trial, prescription-type thing in a controlled environment. Beyond that, though, caffeine kind of has to be embedded in the larger context of coffee. And there is actually evidence that coffee consumption reduces the risk for Alzheimer's disease. Coffee consumption has a lot of benefits. There may be antioxidants in the coffee itself. Caffeine does have a stimulant, has some benefits, but actually we're not sure if it's the caffeine or the coffee, because you also see beneficial effects in green tea as well. So people are starting to wonder if it's the actual drink itself and not specifically the caffeine that's giving the benefit. There's some anti-amyloid properties, anti-Alzheimer properties associated with coffee drinking. And so we haven't had the final say on that, but the evidence suggests that coffee consumption and green tea consumption are favorable in terms of reducing risk. And mechanistically, there is a reason for it.
I have an email from Pat, writes, if it is important to catch Alzheimer's disease before it becomes symptomatic, why does the doctor not recommend genetic testing? Would you recommend genetic testing for somebody with a strong family history of dementia?
That's kind of the cat chasing its tail. A very, very important question. I wish we had a very good answer for it. But the current practice recommendations couldn't recommend not. Now, here's the creative workaround, and this is me speaking as a scientist more than as a director of an institute. There is a company that I'm sure you've already featured called 23andMe. It's a genetics company that actually you take a cheek swab, you send it to this company, pay them $100 or $300, and they'll run a genetic profile of everything in your genes related to diabetes risk, cancer risk, and they actually comment about Alzheimer's risk as well. And so that's the kind of thing that will not show up on your medical record. And what I tell people is if you're dying to know, 23andMe will send you a thing and it'll say, for Alzheimer's risk, it'll say below average risk, or above average risk. And if you're above average risk, you're probably carrying something called the apolipoprotein E4 genotype, which puts you at a slightly increased risk for developing Alzheimer's disease. Mm-hmm. But they don't get into specifics, and that's why there's a little bit of trouble interpreting those tests.
All right. Pat, thanks for that email. Paige in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Paige.
Hi. It's not really so much food-related, but I will get that book because I think it's very interesting. The cookbook. But my question has to do with, I'm only 31, and both of my grandmothers just passed away this past year, one from Alzheimer's and one from just the umbrella of dementia. And I was wondering, because there's such a strong, genetic history there, it seems like there should be somewhere someone would want to research me and people like me and my brothers and sister and see, follow. I mean, I have stress in my life, so I know that, that memory craziness is going to happen. But it seems to me that I can already, at 30 almost exactly, I can start noticing things. And that was before, the passing away of them.
Well, so Thank you, Paige, because we need people like you. That's the only way we're ever going to cure this disease or prevent it. There is a go on the web, and you'll find something called the Alzheimer Prevention Registry, which is which is actually sponsored by my sister institution, the Banner Alzheimer's Institute, and they're trying to recruit 100,000 people nationwide to sign up for this prevention registry in an effort to be able to do a high-throughput screening for a risk as when we come time to be doing these prevention studies. And so I think that's a good first step for you to get involved in, and I would recommend you find the Banner Alzheimer's Institute and the Alzheimer Prevention Registry on the web and try to sign up that way.
All right, Paige, thanks for the question. Brad in Columbus, welcome to the show, Brad.
Oh, hello. First of all, Doctor, I appreciate your dedication to the subject.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yes, I'm a mountain climber. I've been getting in the mountains in the west of this country for the past 20 years, 10,000, 12,000, 14, a lot of 14,000 foot altitudes, a lot of time spent at those altitudes, spending the night at those altitudes. And I thought I had heard something about climbing or getting up in those altitudes maybe being a possible precursor to dementia. What do you know about that?
Well, actually, the physical exertion is probably doing wonderful things to your body and your brain. So, you know, from mountain climbing, physical exertion is at the supreme height of physical exertion. So I think that's, in general, a good thing. And I would bet you, if you're a mountain climber, your body mass index is not big. So that's also a good thing as well. But the lower oxygen concentration, the partial pressure of oxygen, when it goes down, can adversely affect your brain function. That is true. Not necessarily increasing the risk for Alzheimer's, but it does have adverse effects on brain function.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Huh? Thank you, Brad.
Bye.
Doug in Westerville, I'm not sure if Dr. Subba addressed your issue or not, but go ahead.
Well, he did. The doctor did mention that it was uncertain whether it was the caffeine in coffee or coffee itself which could help reduce the onset of Alzheimer's. I'm wondering if there has been any research done, though, on whether decaffeinated coffee or decaffeinated green tea has the same kind of benefits as regular coffee or green tea.
Okay.
Well, that's why I mentioned that we're not sure it's specific to the caffeine, is because it seems to be the caffeine, the coffee and the tea drinking consumption, regardless of whether it has caffeine or not, that seems to have benefit. Tea has something called EGCG, epigallic catechinin, which is a very potent antioxidant free radical scavenger. And so I don't know that it's specifically mechanistically related to Alzheimer's caffeine that causes the benefit. It seems to be a related to the beverages, not necessarily to the caffeine.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Doug. From Ben on Facebook writes, I am curious. I have been informed that omega vitamins are great for memory. I began to take a fish oil supplement to help fend off the possibility of a mental deficiency later in life. My grandfather suffered from dementia before he passed. I am not sure if that is hereditary or not, but I still wished to not inherit this disease if it is hereditary. My doctor advised me to stop taking the fish oil supplements as she claimed they were overdoing my omega intake. I have stopped taking them and have begun to consume more foods that contain these omegas. Is this a good route to be on? Should I permanently stay away from taking omega vitamin supplements, including as I get older?
Yes, yeah, so that's a great summary of where we're at in terms of the debates that occur between the general public and the physician audience. And there's a lot of science to answer that question. Number one, from a dietary standpoint, the CHAP study, the Chicago Health and Aging Project, suggests that consumption of 3 fish meals a week does reduce the risk quite a bit, by about 20-25%. That is a fatty fish, that's fish like salmon, herring, tuna, mackerel, halibut, not the Long John Silver type fish. I wish that was true because those are yummy, but they don't help you. But beyond that, in terms of omega-3s, there are 3 omega-3s, alpha-linolenic, anthocyanolenic acid, epicochinesic acid, and docohexaenoic acid, ALA, EPA, DHA. The one that helps the brain is DHA, not ALA, not EPA. So when you take the fish oil supplement, your target is to get 500 milligrams of DHA per day. But diet and supplements, you can mix the two and you'd be fine.
Doctor,
I disagree.
I'm sorry, Dr. Subba. I think we're going to have to let it go at that.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Subba, he is Research Medical Director at the Banner Sun Health Research Institute in Arizona and co-author of a new cookbook. It's called The Alzheimer's Prevention Cookbook. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.